This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Chinese Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts for this channel, Lori Dickmeyer. In today's episode, I speak with Dr. Nick Jepson about his new book, In China's Wake: How the Commodity Boom Transformed Development Strategies in the Global South. He tells us how he became interested in studying the impact of China's economic growth, and he introduces the main topic of his book, that the commodity boom of 2002 to 2013 produced economic growth for resource-rich countries of the global south, from places like Argentina to Angola and many others. And this gave these countries the financial leeway and opportunity to turn away from international financial institutions like the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. And this allowed them to set their own policy agendas, or at least it gave them the opportunity. In some cases, countries did not decide to turn away from neoliberal policies. Nick Jepson describes five typologies of resource exporters. Again, three which turn away from neoliberalism and two which stay on that path. Then at the end of the interview, he reflects on trends and emerging patterns since the commodity boom. I hope that you enjoy his enlightening thoughts on the topic. Hello, welcome to New Books in Chinese Studies. I'm your host, Lori Dickmeyer. Today we're talking to Dr. Nick Jepson about his new book, In China's Wake: How the Commodity Boom Transformed Development Strategies in the Global South. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me on. It's a pleasure.
Yes. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a research fellow at the moment at the Global Development Institute. That's the University of Manchester in the UK. I'm from the UK, as you can probably tell. And I'm from Rotherham, which is kind of sort of Rust Belt post-industrial town in the north of England. I am a political economist, I suppose, working on development issues, but I have a background a little bit. My history, my undergrad was in mainly in history, and I guess what I really study is sort of the rise of China in the 21st century and the implications of that for the rest of the world, particularly the global south.
That's fantastic. So I wonder if you could tell us how you became interested in this topic, and particularly, how did you come to write this book, In China's Wake?
Yeah, sure. So, I think I say in the acknowledgements that this started off as a PhD project, and that is correct. This is a sort of, you know, very much updated and revised version of, or at least based on my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation. But the origins go back quite a bit longer than that in many ways. I think, you know, when I was doing my undergraduate degree, and that's a long time ago now, it's 20 years ago now, I did an exchange year in Buenos Aires. And when I was there in Argentina, that was, 2001, 2002, right in the middle of maybe the worst economic crisis in Argentina's history. A lot of political strife going on. They had the IMF there and an agreement bailout with the IMF that committed them to certain conditions and certain economic policies, you know, very tight austerity policies, lots of cuts to public services. The economy was going through a major recession, and these policies were clearly kind of making it worse. And I guess I struggled to understand how this was happening, given that nominally, at least, the country was a democracy. These policies were extremely unpopular. And yet there didn't seem to be any alternative to kind of implementing them. And that's kind of what got me interested in these questions of sort of global political economy. And from that, I suppose I began to look at why there didn't seem to be alternatives in some countries to those kinds of policies and under what conditions those alternatives might emerge. And that's sort of what led me to the commodity boom and to the effect of China on world markets.
Interesting. So now let's start to talk about your book a little bit. Your introduction very clearly lays out your argument and your claims. I wonder if you might walk us through your basic outline that you have and your argument about China, the commodity boom, and development in the global South.
Yeah. Okay. So, I begin from the facts of the commodity boom. So around kind of the first decade and a half of the 21st century, something like that, you do begin to see this boom in commodity prices, and particularly for fossil fuels and for metals as well, agriculture to some extent, but particularly look at metals and fuels here. It quickly became obvious that China was the sort of driving force behind that. I mean, you know, I could go into the sort of empirical stuff maybe in a few minutes, but that you get this sort of inflection point around 2002, where obviously China is booming economic growth since the late 1970s, but there's this inflection point around the early 2000s where it starts to require increasing amounts of imported commodities rather than relying on domestic supplies. And it's that I'm basically arguing is the major force that drives this boom in commodity prices. And then from that, the next step is to say, well, what impact does that have on countries which are exporters of these commodities? And really what I'm sort of saying is that this commodity boom essentially provides a new stream of revenue for those countries, and that it is that revenue is largely beyond the control of organizations like the International Monetary Fund that I mentioned in the context of Argentina, of capital markets, of donor countries, which donor agencies, which are important in many of these developing countries as well. And that with that revenue comes a sort of shift in bargaining power between those commodity exporters, these resource-rich states, and those are the sources of power, so the IMF and the World Bank, etc., and capital markets. That revenue stream is then used by some of these countries to break with those sorts of policies, sort of liberal economic policies around this time. And you see a growth among some of these commodity exporters of a variety of sort of experiments and new political economic formations, sets of policies that kind of flourish in this era, and that I'm kind of trying to connect this to a larger argument about sort of broad historical patterns in sort of shape and process of global capitalism, and how the rise of China can be seen as sort of a world historical process within that is kind of sort of rewiring some of the main sort of circuits of global capitalism. And there's quite a lot of books written about China in the global South, China in Africa, China in Latin America, China in Asia as well. That tend, that's changing a little bit, to focus on the sort of direct impact. So Chinese loans, Chinese investment, these sorts of things. And I suppose what I'm sort of saying is that while all those things are really very important, it may be that this sort of second order effect, this indirect impact of China's effect as it rises and grows on the global political economy and how that reshapes world markets may open and close sort of different possibilities for development in the global south as it goes, even if unintentionally in many cases, so that in some senses the indirect impacts may be more important than the direct ones. So, I mean, that's the sort of very basic structure, but we can flesh out the details as we go along, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. And before we get into that, I think the listeners would be interested in how you went about researching all of this and gathering your data. So I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your research process.
Yeah, absolutely. So, this started out, as I say, with this idea about sort of looking at emerging alternatives and the kind of the noticing the fact that they seem to be in commodity exporting countries, the connection to China and you know, reading about that for a large period of it and getting up to speed with how commodity markets work, that sort of thing. Initially, this was going to be just a comparison of that process playing out in two countries. I think it initially started with Zambia and Bolivia. But that then expanded to three with using Jamaica as a counterfactual case, which again, we can talk about in more detail in a moment if you want. But I swapped out Bolivia for Ecuador just because I thought the sort of China facts was more evident there and maybe the process of what was going on was a bit more interesting in some ways, although Bolivia is very important too. And then did field work in those three locations, interviews with sort of political and economic elites, really. And then got into this qualitative comparative analysis technique, which is still a qualitative method, but basically a way of maintaining a kind of case-based approach, but expanding your ability to make comparisons. So being able to compare across, in my case, 15 different cases in a kind of systematic way. And from having to read into those different cases, that sort of gave me a broader perspective on commodity exporters in general. And from that, I began to think about patterns and response across them. And from there, I developed the typology, which has ended up being really the kind of centerpiece of the book, I think.
Mm. Okay, so now I think we have a very good overview of your project. I hope we can talk about some of these individual chapters. Your first chapter is World Markets in China's Wake, and here you explain how China contributed to this commodity boom, which you've told us a bit about already. But you also introduce some of the theory you're using or some of the previous thinkers. So I wonder if you can tell us about this idea of overlapping secular cycles of accumulation in your work, which you highlight.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm aware you're a historian, right?
And yes, I mean, that's right.
So I know most historians are, I think, in most cases, rightly skeptical about anything that kind of smacks of sort of some kind of master process of history or determinism and that sort of thing. But I mean, really, this is coming from Giovanni Righi, as ideas is about the cycles of accumulation and him building on Braudel's work. Also interested in sort of William Sewell Jr.'s sort of take on this, kind of eventful history, but the idea being that at a kind of level of abstraction, at least, then there is a kind of repeating pattern of crisis in capitalism, and the details may be very different, and that can be incredibly important in the way that these things play out. But that if you do look at history stretching back a few centuries, then there does seem to be an abstract kind of cyclical pattern of kind of regimes of accumulation, let's say. So complex of different sort of technological innovations of political structures, institutions, cultures, all kinds of different things. Very complex to kind of get into, but that those essentially foster the conditions for relatively stable economic growth worldwide, obviously with major variation geographically, for a particular period, you know, a few decades, three or four decades, something like that, which eventually reaches, kind of runs into the sand after a while, because the sort of marginal gains that can be made from that particular way of organizing the global economy are gradually exhausted. The idea being that then you get an inflection point and a point of crisis, at which point there's more of a shift to growth pattern based on finance more than kind of material growth. Eventually, the sort of contradictions of that become too difficult to get over, is a period of instability and volatility. And that what emerges from the sort of ashes of that, I suppose, is that another kind of complex, another location in the global economy may be positioned to best take advantage of the situation. And that then becomes the new center of accumulation from which a new sort of cycle emerges. And while I'm not necessarily saying, you know, that we are at the point of a new accumulation cycle starting or anything like that, I suppose in one sense I'm sort of posing the question of, well, if that was happening, what would it look like? I mean, I would say that, you know, as Arrighi points out, this phenomenon of cycles is, you know, is according to him a kind of empirical phenomenon, and it's something that needs to be explained rather than something that explains things. But if we've seen that pattern repeat itself, at least in abstract level, a few times, it could be, and this is where I kind of distance myself from the kind of Wallasteinian kind of world system stuff, but clearly that's an influence. But it could be that, you know, if the pattern maintains itself, then what would this kind of look like? And it's at least possible to make the argument that, the nascent stages of a sort of new emerging regime of accumulation, possibly centered on China, could be emerging. And that even if that isn't happening, what we are seeing is definitely a sort of new center of accumulation in the global economy that, you know, I use this expression a few times about sort of as China grows, its sort of weight in the global economy grows and its gravitational pull on the rest of global capitalism does as well, which means it is driving accumulation processes which previously would have been centered on countries in the global north, particularly the United States. So that's the sort of, deep theoretical background in which these ideas are situated. But, you know, I do want to stress these aren't sort of mechanical processes that are determining everything that's going on or anything. These are just the broad patterns.
Okay, awesome. Thank you for that. As an historian, I did appreciate your next chapter, chapter two, which talked through shifting global regimes over time regarding natural resources and development. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could walk us through some of those touchstones of these major shifts in global regimes that do impact the resource exporters that you look at in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think, going back all the way to kind of the colonial era, then sort of commodity and resource extractions being a fundamental aspect of development, however you understand development, and for some of the sort of European colonizers in African countries, in Latin America and parts of Asia too, that was associated even to the extent of saying, well, you know, typically Europeans would arrive somewhere and see that local people were not necessarily exploiting the, let's say, copper resources which lay under their soil or something like this. And it was to some extent part of the sort of, you know, the ideological kind of, you know, so-called civilizing mission of the Europeans, that the idea being that these resources were put there to be exploited, and if the local people weren't going to do it, then it was almost the duty of the colonizers to go there and dig it up and start using it. And lots and, you know, parts of what now make up kind of global economy during the colonial era were major sites of resource extraction. And that's things like minerals and fuels, but it's also agricultural products as well. And societies wholly reordered around resource extraction. If you look at the history of somewhere like Bolivia and how important the silver mines were to the Spanish Empire, for example. But moving into the kind of, you know, the post-World War II era and the kind of development project and that sort of ideology, beginning with particularly Truman and in the Cold War context about ideas like modernization theory, and then, of course, competing Soviet ideas about development and sort of competition, Cold War competition in what at the time was known as the Third World, offers this sort of prospect of development, of in some sense becoming more like one of these two, you know, quote unquote, model societies in one way or another. And obviously there's a big difference in terms of the kind of the advice that the Soviets given and the Americans are giving, but there are commonalities as well. And a lot of it is around how to use commodities in order to modernize, in order to industrialize. And a lot of that is about developing domestic industries by using commodity revenues to sort of do that. I mean, I won't get into the full ins and outs of that. I mean, there's some successes and some problems. There is a kind of inflection point around the 1970s, where obviously the 70s is the decade where you get the Arab-Israeli war and the oil embargo, the OPEC crisis, the price of oil peaks. And it looks as though, in some senses, this is a, you know, moment where some countries in the global south are maybe coming together, not just the sort of oil exporters, but you have the new international economic order. There's been quite a lot of scholarship about this, in fact, since I wrote the book. And the idea of following OPEC's example and coming together as groups of, say, sugar producers or bauxite producers or whatever it may be, to act as a cartel and to try and set the price of your exports rather than accepting the kind of world market price over which, you know, economic actors in the global north have a great deal more power than in the south. And so there's this moment of kind of challenge. But to a large extent, it fails. And part of the reason is because it's harder to get those agreements, those cartels going in other areas than oil, partly because, for instance, limiting oil supplies is, you know, not quite this simple, but more or less a matter of turning on or off the taps, whereas something like copper is a little more complicated than that, and it's harder to get agreements that sort of work. The other thing is that a lot of the countries that are, say, bauxite exporters or copper exporters are also oil importers. So economically, while the oil price, you know, kind of the oil crisis and the oil price spike is going on, they're also suffering economically because the price of their oil imports has gone up quite drastically. And in fact, in the 1970s, for a lot of commodities, you begin to see a decline in prices, which leaves many of these countries, which at this moment are pursuing this sort of developmentalist project, trying to build up their own domestic industries, trying to industrialize, trying to build up their economies in various kinds of ways, are losing their economic basis to do that, the kind of export revenue. And so they end up covering it with increasing amounts of loans. And those loans are kind of fed through at the other end of the cycle by the oil boom itself, because you get the kind of windfall profits that particularly the OPEC members, I should say, by the way, in case anybody doesn't know, OPEC is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, mainly the Arab world, but countries, you know, in Latin America, Africa, Asia, also part of that. But the OPEC countries reaping such windfall profits that they can't be profitably invested in their own domestic economies. So they end up getting deposited in so-called Eurodollar accounts, particularly in London. And then this kind of wave of liquidity into the global financial system eventually finds its way into relatively cheap loans to the countries on the other end that are struggling, particularly commodity exporters in the global south, that end up borrowing more and more to cover their development plans. In the late 1970s, and I won't go into the background for this because it took another 10 minutes to explain, but you get in the United States the Volcker shock, the raising of interest rates in the US, which effectively raises the cost of borrowing for those countries which have already got themselves into huge amounts of debt, sparks a debt crisis, particularly in Latin America and Africa, but across the third world as it was then. And that really sort of sets up the conditions for a shift towards neoliberalism generally. And do you want me to go on and say something about that?
Yes, you could. But I think we might also move on to talk about how you decided to compare the different countries in your study as well. So whichever direction you'd like to take, feel free.
Okay, sure. So I will just briefly say, I suppose, that what happens is that, because I think this is important to set up the rest of the book, is that in countries that have got themselves into a lot of debt and many commodity exporters among them, the way that the debt crisis is dealt with essentially is by turning to international organizations like the International Monetary Fund, who come along and, dominant ideology in those places by the late 1970s, early 1980s is what you can loosely call neoliberalism. And I won't get into the weeds too much about what that means, but, kind of at the level of policy, essentially privatization, deregulation, liberalization of economies. And these are through these what are called structural adjustment plans, the policies that are presented as essentially conditions of getting these loans. And the argument is that while it's not simply about the IMF going around the world and sort of imposing its will on different countries, you get many elites in the various countries that absolutely agree with these policies. The argument I'm making is that for countries that are in high levels of debt, from then on, it's not really possible for them to break with those policies because of the need to please the IMF, to please capital markets, to please international donors as well. And really the idea is that that's the situation at the beginning of the commodity boom, and that's the conditions under which, I set up the argument about breaks from those sorts of policies being possible. So, sorry, what was the other part of the question?
I was jumping ahead. We definitely needed to talk about neoliberalism. I was kind of thinking ahead to your third chapter when you set up this issue of why you're looking at national indicators to measure this global phenomenon that is occurring. So I think that's important for us to understand then, the rest of your book and your typology system and the different types.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the kind of that idea of this articulation between the global and the national level is sort of something I was very interested in, and something I think is very important and quite hard, I think, to kind of get right and to sort of tease out. I mean, again, I want to stress that, this isn't a mechanical process. I'm not talking about as in, let's say, some of the cruder versions of dependency theory in the 1970s or whatever, that global forces determine local events or local conditions or whatever. But I'm just, I suppose I'm sort of saying that they kind of parameterize the options that are available to local actors. And the other thing I would say as well is that, you know, without getting into the sort of theoretical roots of what exactly neoliberalism means or whatever, I think one of the easiest ways to sort of detect it is simply in terms of national level policy sets. I mean, and it is nation states that make those policies by and large, and therefore that's the kind of site of analysis for this second part of the book, which is about whether particular countries actually make a break with what I call neoliberalism, is, you know, as a set of economic policies, is how I'm kind of defining it and measuring it for these purposes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So now I think we can get into this typology system that you set up. So maybe you can tell us about how you arrived at these five different typologies that you have for the resource exporters, and as you said, you know, how they were in some cases able to break away from neoliberalism and in other cases not. So what are the main factors that you were taking into consideration when you were doing this typology?
Well, I started to notice that there was a correspondence between the different kinds of policy responses that you're seeing, and there's a variety of them, and the kind of, in broad terms, the sort of state-society complex domestically in each country. So I pick out a couple of factors that I think are particularly important, and I think that the first one is about the domestic economic elite, the capitalists, if you like, the kind of capitalist class, however you want to term it. First of all, you know, kind of how large and kind of strong and unified or not is that group of people? But then also crucial, I think, is how autonomous that that economic elite is from the state. So there's a lot of countries that I look at, say somewhere like Angola, where there clearly are people that you would call capitalists, right? There are people that own businesses. There are a number of very rich individuals with considerable economic power. But most of their economic power is tied to the state in one way or another. So whether that is getting contracts or licenses, or is actually about controlling state-owned enterprises or those sorts of things, you don't have what you have in other countries. So let's say something like Peru or Argentina, where you have a capitalist class which can exist relatively autonomous of whatever the state is doing. And therefore, I think that makes a big difference in this. And, you know, we get into the hows and whys and talk about each of the types, I suppose. Mm-hmm. The other part is the kind of other side of that equation, which, you know, is broadly speaking, what I call popular classes and popular class movements. So the same thing about, you know, how strong and unified are these. And I mean broadly conceived in the sense that partly talking about, you know, kind of, well, I guess, working class in the traditional sense. But I think particularly when you look at countries in the global south, you need to expand that. So also looking at workers in the informal sector, in some cases, urban middle classes, indigenous movements, you know, so quite an expansive category there. And that, in various different ways, is essentially the basis of where these five types come from. And I think you can see a correspondence in the pattern of those social groups and how they relate to one another and the sort of policy directions that were taken during this boom period.
Yes. So now we can talk about each of these five types, I hope. And it would be great if you can tell us a little bit about each, and maybe also, you know, discuss some of these examples, or maybe one or two of your main examples for each. So first we have the neo-developmentalist type of resource exporter. So could you tell us what that was and you were discussing Brazil and Argentina for this one. So if you want to focus on one of those countries or tell us a little bit about both, it's up to you.
Sure. So with Argentina and Brazil, I mean, yeah, so I call this the neo-developmentalist type. That name comes from the sort of economic theories which were beginning to become pretty popular in both countries, particularly Brazil around that time. Essentially a kind of attempt to blend sort of the experience of the East Asian tiger economies, the sort of export-oriented growth, with some of the old kind of structuralist ideas of developing national industries from that post-World War II period that I talked about before. And those ideas are kind of floating around in this time, but I think it's the boom that provides the kind of political opportunity for those policies to be enacted by forces that these ideas favor, in a sense. So the five types are each kind of ideal type. So this type, I would say that the ideotypical features are that you have a relatively strong and relatively unified domestic capitalist class. But within that, in this period, what the boom does is present conditions for the ascendance of the kind of industrial, productive, more domestically focused, broadly speaking, elements of that. But then the other part of the kind of political coalition includes some key popular class groups. So the situation I was talking about right at the beginning in Argentina in the early 2000s, you have a politically powerful movement of the unemployed, for example, the picoteros, as they were called, that get integrated into this kind of ruling political coalition that takes power in the aftermath of that recession and really rides a commodity boom in order to implement a quite different economic model in many ways that is less wedded to kind of orthodox liberal prescriptions. You know, there's more use of the state in terms of favoring industrial producers. There's some limited import substitution industrialization, but about supporting kind of creating kind of national champion companies and upgrading competitiveness at home and abroad with help of industrial policy. And some sharing of the gains. So you get things like minimum wage hikes, you get some kind of social redistributive schemes, those kinds of things. So, for example, in Argentina, I mean, we already talked about the sort of depression around 2001-2002. The context for that is that in the 1990s, the local currency, the peso, is pegged one-to-one to the dollar, so it's highly overvalued, which means that the local economy is very uncompetitive. That means domestic manufacturing suffers. But actually what happens as well is a process of those companies getting more concentrated, so the survivors become more powerful, so to speak. So that means there's this kind of strong economic bloc that is kind of ready to assert itself when the conditions present themselves. You get this period around 2002-2003, which is pretty sort of politically chaotic, but a lot of emergency measures to deal with the sort of social suffering that's going on start as ad hoc schemes and then become part of the sort of the new model as it gets developed, particularly associated with the Kirchners, Néstor and Cristina, kind of populist leaders, Peronists that come to power. Néstor in 2005, I think it is, and again, roll out this model of infrastructure spending. And I think what's important with Argentina and Brazil particularly is that, especially Argentina, they are relying on in part soy exports here. So it's a bit different from my focus elsewhere, which is on fuels and minerals, so metals, those sorts of things. Soy, I think, is the one kind of agricultural crop in all this which has this effect of empowering countries to make these breaks. And the reason, I think, is first because it's subject to the same sort of China effect. So what's happening in China is that as incomes rise, people are adding more and more kind of meat to their diets, and that's particularly pork in the case of China. Now, Chinese pigs tend to eat soy that's grown in the US, and it's grown in Brazil, and it's grown in Argentina. Now, the other thing about the soy industry is that it's more mechanized and it's more concentrated among a small number of firms than most agricultural industries, which means governments can treat it a bit like an extractive industry like oil or mining, in that it's relatively easy to tax, take the kind of windfall of this commodity boom, and then take the rent from that and redirect it towards your favoured economic model. So in this case, supporting domestic producers and also some amount of redistribution under the Kirchners in Argentina, particularly.
Mm. Very interesting. So we have another interesting typology for us to discuss, the extractive oligarchic type, which you locate in Angola and Kazakhstan. So they were both, or they're both two exporters of crude oil. What else did they have in common during the commodity boom?
Well, these are the sorts of cases. I mean, I talked before about the importance of whether there's a domestic capitalist class which is kind of autonomous from the state. And I think in these two cases, that's not there. There are capitalists, certainly, but they're very much tied to sort of state patronage in terms of whether they're able to earn money or not and able to operate domestically. And that changes the sort of balance of power domestically, I think, and means that in these cases, the main factor in terms of whether they make a break in policy orientation depends really upon those in charge of the state itself. So the bureaucrats, the political leaders, these sorts of things. And in the case of the oligarchic extractivist type, I also think that the key factor that's determining that decision on, or not necessarily determining, but very important in the decision of the kind of state managers as to whether to make this break or not, is that in contrast to one of the other types, so that's the donor-dependent orthodoxy, which we'll talk about in a moment perhaps, the difference is that there's no real history of depending on flows of aid as a key revenue source. So the argument is really that in the other type, so the donor-dependent type, there's a history of relying upon flows of aid, and therefore people in charge of those countries don't necessarily want to risk the relationships that they have built up with donors over the previous decades, and so are a lot more cautious about deviating from the kinds of policies that donors tend to want to see, which tend to be these liberal economic policies. You don't have that somewhere like Angola. So Angola, kind of interesting case in the sense that it emerges, I mean, it's a very troubled history. You know, they mm-hmm. fight an independence war against Portugal in the 1960s until the Carnation Revolution in the 70s. Then immediately a sort of civil war that's a proxy battle in the Cold War that only ends in the early 2000s. And at this point, donors and the World Bank, etc., very interested in talking to the government that's come through that civil war, and various negotiations go on, and they want them to adopt, you know, these basic policy set of kind of liberalisation, privatisation, etc. Now, the Angolan government at the time is not keen on this, partly because, you know, one of the basic tenets of that neoliberal set of ideas is about really sort of shrinking the state in some respects. And because this is a country that's just emerged from civil war, that state is not so keen on that idea. In fact, it wants to assert itself across its territory and along its domain. So they unlike what happens in, say, Mozambique on the other side of the continent, which goes through a very similar process of civil war independence war followed by then liberalization and going to donors, etc. Because of the oil boom and because of, you know, the takeoff of Chinese demand, especially, Angola finds itself in a position where it can say no to that, and it can really sort of dictate its own terms to some extent. So you get a very different economic model that appears there, which is heavily focused on infrastructure, particularly building rail lines, urban redevelopment in the capital, Luanda. It's not in any way inclusive development. It's very much focused on, you know, the needs of the elites and these sorts of things. But it is nevertheless, you know, a fast growing economy. There is a sort of middle class of perhaps 500,000 people sort of nurtured purposefully by the Angolan state during this period. And I think Angola's importance in some sense, because I do want to stress with all this that I'm not necessarily saying all these different sort of types and all the different experiments that go on are all necessarily favorable, right? I mean, all of these things are for better or worse. It's simply making the point that the confluence of factors around this time of the commodity boom sort of opened the door for various experiments for better or worse. And certainly it's a very distinct one in the Angolan case, though there are similarities with Kazakhstan on that sort of state-led development model, and about, you know, kind of infrastructure heavy development and those sorts of things. But that, you know, this isn't, again, it's not necessarily inclusive development. It's not necessarily a positive for your average Angola, although that's perhaps debatable.
So you also have a third typology here that we haven't discussed yet, the extractivist redistributive type, that is one of these types that was also able to break away from neoliberalism. So I wonder if we might cover that and then move on to the other two types you have remaining that were not able to break away.
Yeah, absolutely. In this case, with the what I call extractivist redistributive, so this is the, I suppose a lot of people would be familiar with this in terms of the kind of more radical leftist governments of the 2000s that appeared in Latin America, so Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela. I group these together because I think that, you know, along those axes that I talked about, they have similar characteristics. So you have a capitalist class in these countries, and it is relatively autonomous from the state, but it's also, generally speaking, weak or divided. So, I don't know, take the example of Ecuador. I believe it's a bit similar in this regard, that you have in Ecuador a power center of the economic elite in the capital Quito, in the highlands, and then a different kind of rival faction in on the coast in the commercial capital of Guayaquil. You know, over various iterations, these two factions sort of almost fight each other to a standstill in a way, and the country is very unstable through the 1990s. And that kind of division, essentially, along with the kind of material factors that appear through the commodity boom, presents an opening for different political forces to kind of come through, and that what you get in all three cases is a sort of populist movement, you know, particularly in Venezuela and Ecuador, with these sort of charismatic populist figures, very familiar in some ways from Latin American history. But all three governments come to power and kind of govern with this populist political style, so majoritarianism, sort of constant mobilization, use of referenda, refounding of the country, you know, so-called in the sense of new constitutions, which allows them to sort of overhaul their country's institutions and push through relatively radical agenda in the sense that, you know, a bigger role for the state, certainly, you know, a much larger take from their extractive industries for the state, which is then redistributed in various forms, with a focus on redistribution and on social spending. These three are sort of less successful perhaps, or at least, or maybe put less stress on, you know, kind of development in the sense of growing new industries and diversification and those sorts of things. Although Ecuador does make some attempts in that direction. Bolivia does too, to some limited extent. But yeah, so I think, you know, if you look at Ecuador, for example, under Rafael Correa, you get the tripling of sort of conditional cash payments. So this human development bond, you get things like a crackdown on the local financial sector. You get a big push in terms of public investment and new infrastructure projects. You get some quite ambitious attempts to build new industries, those sorts of things, which are not necessarily all that successful, but at least in kind of metrics of sort of poverty, inequality and those sorts of things actually does relatively well. Now, until the commodity boom ends, of course, and then we start to get a variety of problems, particularly and most notoriously in the case of Venezuela.
Mm. Yes. So we now turn to your two types of resource exporters that were unable to break away from the neoliberal path for different reasons. So I wonder if we might briefly touch on both of those. So we have the donor-dependent orthodoxy type first, that includes Zambia, Laos, and Mongolia as well.
Yes, so this is the point I was making before about the importance of whether countries have a history of aid dependence. So I see these countries as similar to the kind of Angola, Kazakhstan, the oligarchic extractivist type, as I say. But the difference is that they don't break away. And again, there's not a large autonomous capitalist class in these countries. So that's what makes them similar to the kind of Angola type. But that because these countries have a history of depending quite heavily on flows of aid, my kind of argument is that the people in charge are reluctant to risk those relationships and so are a lot more cautious in terms of the policies that they apply. And I mean, Zambia is one of the places that I did field work. You do get a populist government, the Patriotic Front of Michael Sata, that wins power in 2013 and in fact looks like it might go down the kind of Ecuador-Venezuela route. But actually, in many respects, proves a lot more kind of cautious than that, and more or less kind of sticks with orthodox policies and similar in the other cases as well.
Yes, and so we have now your final type, the homegrown orthodoxy type. So why did these countries stay on the neoliberal path during the commodity boom?
Well, I think you can kind of pair this type in some senses to the extractivist redistributive type in some ways, in that there is an autonomous capitalist class, and there are also in some cases popular movements in these countries as well. But because the capitalist class in these countries, the sort of local domestic economic elite, is more kind of powerful, more unified, and is able to kind of, and these are all very schematic, of course. It's kind of described a lot more kind of nuance in the book, of course. But those groups are able to kind of hold on to power, and that they're no longer constrained by kind of global market conditions. The option is there for them to go for a more kind of radical direction if they wanted to. But here I'm arguing that the domestic kind of capitalist groups there are more outward oriented than, say, a Brazil or Argentina. They're more partnered with transnational capital, particularly located in the global north. So you take Peru, for example, you have quite an important domestic mining sector, which is heavily kind of mixed in and partners with transnational mining firms as well. So their interests are relatively shared. And I argue that really it's that route that is sort of, you know, kind of the most influential factor in keeping these countries along that sort of relatively orthodox road. Although there are, you know, here and there policies which do change. The space is there. It's just not exploited because it's not seen as being in the interests of those groups that continue to retain political and economic power.
Yes. So you have one final chapter in your book after you've gone through these typologies. And in this chapter, you reflect on your major findings, and you also consider current and future scenarios about commodity price movements, China's trajectory, and political economic impacts. So I wonder if you might reflect on this now. It's been a little while since your book came out, not too long, but perhaps you have new insights on this. I don't know. What changes have we seen since the commodity boom of 2002 to 2013, and what might we expect in the future? What are your thoughts?
I think the first thing to say is that the commodity boom, obviously, it did end. So you get a fall in commodity prices from around 2013, 2014, something like that, partly because growth slows a bit in China, and partly as well is because there's a sort of lagged supply response. So when prices go up, various commodities, that spurs a kind of global drive for investment. So there are various companies looking for new sources of copper and iron ore and nickel and oil and etc. And once those start to come online, then obviously supply increases, and then that starts to push prices down again. So there's a cyclical element to this, and you certainly see an impact in terms of political and economic trajectories. And I think in some ways it sort of reinforces my argument, because what it's saying is that when these global conditions no longer obtain, I suppose, that the constraints on policy are tightened again. You know, the kind of the ability of these countries to forge an independent path is undermined by the disappearance of commodity revenue and the need to turn back towards global capital markets and donors and the IMF and these sorts of things. And even at the time when I was writing the book, you know, that the most of these sort of different kind of breaks or experiments had fallen by the wayside in a variety of different ways. So already mentioned, you know, you get a collapse completely in Venezuela, horrendously so. You get a return of neoliberalism in places like Argentina and Brazil, also to some extent in Ecuador. Bolivia, you know, you had the sort of the coup and then return of Morales's party. And I think that's something, since I wrote the book, that maybe looks kind of interesting in the horizon, is that even though commodity boom has come and gone and those conditions aren't there anymore, it has left an lasting impression on a lot of these countries' politics. So, for instance, in Argentina, you've had Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner come back as vice president now and under a government that's sort of Peronist and sort of a bit leftist, but maybe softer than previously. In Ecuador, Correa left after 10 years and you get a return of neoliberalism there under his successor, Lenin Moreno. But Andrés Arauz, who's kind of Correa's candidate, may well win the election that's coming up this month. And as I say, you know, Morales's party back in power in Bolivia. And so I think the test for these kind of, you know, leaders that may come back and may still inherit some of the ideas from their commodity boom era predecessors is, what are their plans going to look like in an era where the conditions look very different, where even before the impact of the pandemic, of course, where commodity prices are relatively low, where levels of debt are rising. And I guess the fear is, you know, coming back to something I said near the beginning of this, that the fear is that maybe we're going through a repeat of the 1970s in some ways, right? So you get this, to some extent, a kind of challenge in a very different way from countries in the global south to the prevailing political and economic order. But the sort of overextension that happens from that and the indebtedness that happens from that then stores up problems, and you end up with this kind of sovereign debt crisis, which is beginning to happen now. And it's a very interesting question as to how, you know, these governments are going to deal with these very different conditions now, I suppose.
Fascinating stuff. Well, Nick, we've taken up a lot of your time and we don't want to keep you, but we do have a traditional question we ask at the end of these podcasts, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, actually, exactly the question I was just talking about, which is not necessarily those specific governments, but on debt, and particularly on China still. So China's role as a creditor, as a lender of money to countries across the global south for particularly things like infrastructure projects, the Belt and Road Initiative, this sort of thing. And because, I mean, this started before the pandemic and before, you know, countries started running into major problems in terms of being able to repay their loans. But we sort of know what happens when a country struggles to repay its loans to say, the IMF, and how the process works, that it has for a bailout and all that. But until very recently, we've known virtually nothing about what happens when countries struggle to pay back China. So the project was really about looking at that. And it's become much broader and I think a lot more immediate in some ways with the COVID crisis, because you have a lot of countries that are exactly in this position. So particularly looking at a different range of countries, so Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Kenya, probably Montenegro in Europe as well. So quite a different project, but still about China's impact on development and on the global political economy.
Yeah, that sounds like a great project to work on right now. Well, thank you again for being on the show. I really enjoyed it. I know from reading your book that I learned a lot about China's impact on all these different countries around the world, and it was really fascinating. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to New Books in Chinese Studies, part of the New Books Network.